It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The ayes to the right, 390. The noes to the left, 81. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Unlocked.
Parliament has shown in both the Commons and in the Lords that it is capable of responding to the gravity and the urgency of the challenge that our country faces and the risks, the very immediate risks, to jobs, public services and to families across the country if we drift. But none of us could have imagined we would be in this situation in the first place. These are unprecedented circumstances, but also should serve as no precedent for the future when, as we all hope, normal times might be restored.
Sandy Rios with you. That was earlier this week, what happened in the British Parliament, and since then lots of other things have transpired. By the time you hear this, it will be Friday. Friday, today, is the deadline for the United Kingdom to leave the European Union, with or without a deal. It's supposed to happen at 11 o'clock in the morning in British time. So we won't know at this point what the decision is going to be. The plan is that some are trying to get Theresa May out of office to vote no confidence on her earlier in the week. That might have happened, but this is the mysterious unknown right now. But today is the day. It will either leave or not leave. And so what's this all about? You might remember that 3 years ago, the British people voted, and it was a shock, 52% to 48% to leave the EU. And yet, because the Parliament could not agree on the details of that, it has dragged on and dragged on, and deadlines have been passed. And so what is going to happen and what should happen? I've asked Niles Gartner to join us this morning. He is a British conservative commentator. He's the director of the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation, and he's a former aide to the famous and loved by me, certainly, Margaret Thatcher, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Niles.
Good morning, Sandy.
Well, this is complex. And so I'm going to try to make it simple with my questions. It was a shock when the Brits voted to embrace Brexit and to get out of the EU. Who was for it and who was against it? Basically,
well, I was in the UK actually on the night of the referendum in 2016, and it was a huge victory for sovereignty and self-determination. 17.4 million Britons voted to leave the European Union, and those who backed Brexit were not just not only conservatives, but also about a third of Labour Party voters actually voted for Brexit as well. And so you did have, support, in fact, across the political spectrum for Brexit. And I think what united Brexit supporters was the belief that Britain should be a truly free, sovereign nation outside of the European Union, free to shape its own destiny, laws, trade policy, protect its own borders, and shape its own future, actually, as a truly independent country. And I think the British people really felt that enough is enough, and that after over four decades of membership of the European Union and formerly the European Economic Community, it was time for Britain once again to be in full control of its own future. And the reality is that members of the European Union, there are 28 members of the EU at the moment, including Britain, EU member states are not truly sovereign countries, and about two-thirds of British law, for example, is decided now in Brussels. Britain does not have control over its own borders. It doesn't control its own trade policy. Its courts are subject to the rulings of European courts. And the American people would never, ever accept what the British people have had to put up with for the last 4.5 decades. And the American people would never accept the idea of a foreign power telling them what to do, which is exactly the situation with EU membership.
Yes, well, right, you're absolutely right, Niall. And I think one thing that we can't quite understand, and this seems probably pretty rudimentary to you, but since the vote was, you know, pretty decisively in favor of leaving the EU, why in the world does Britain need the EU's permission for the details? Why couldn't you have just demanded your own, just made your own, say, well, this is how we're going to leave. This is how it's going to happen. How did this get all so entangled?
Yeah, well, of course, it's been a very, very complex, scenario over the past, couple of years or so. So basically, under EU law, a country is able to leave the European Union by triggering what is known as Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which sets in place a two-year period during which time that country negotiates a sort of exit deal with the European Union. So that's what Britain has been doing for the last 2 years. Unfortunately, the British Prime Minister Theresa May did not get a very good deal with the European Union. This deal has been rejected 3 times by the House of Commons. And Britain is still actually stuck inside the European Union. So April 12th is the new deadline for Britain to leave the EU. But it's likely that we're going to see a continuing extension of British membership of the European Union because Theresa May, the Prime Minister, refuses to take Britain out under what is known as a no-deal scenario. And so Britain remains stuck for the time being in the European Union. Unless we have a prime minister who has the strength and the courage to take Britain out of the European Union under a no deal scenario.
Niles, could this be explained by through American eyes? Could it be explained like this? Is it possible that your parliament, both houses, are similar to both of our houses in that they, in some areas, refuse to really represent the wishes of the American people, whether it's on immigration or health care or whatever? We have sort of a rogue representation right now where they kind of defy the will of the people. Is that what's happening with the parliament?
Yeah, I would say that that's a very accurate reflection of what's going on. So parliament has 650 MPs, members of parliament. About 500 of those MPs voted against Brexit in the 2016 referendum. And there's a huge disconnect between the will of the British people and where most of Parliament, as the Parliament has been trying desperately to block Brexit, undermine Brexit, derail it. And it hasn't helped that you've got a Prime Minister in charge who also didn't vote for Brexit herself. And so her leadership of Brexit has been very half-hearted. She negotiated a very bad deal with the European Union. And so the combination of a very weak prime minister together with an anti-Brexit parliament has made the Brexit process incredibly difficult. And so there is this huge, huge disconnect between where the British people are and where the political elites are. And this is the same kind of thing that you see in the United States as well, actually. And I think, unfortunately, the reality is that parliament is doing its very best to try and overturn the Brexit result.
So this vote
is a very, very dangerous move.
Yeah, so this vote earlier in the week by Parliament was final, that there would not be a no-deal Brexit. Was that a final decision? Is that it? By 11 o'clock this morning, they cannot leave without some sort of a deal with the European Union?
Well, so Parliament has voted against a no-deal. However, a no-deal Brexit, whereby Britain basically simply just operates with the rest of the world under World Trade Organization terms, which I think would be an ideal situation. A no-deal situation is the default situation if Theresa May does not secure parliamentary approval for the EU withdrawal agreement that she's negotiated with the EU. So regardless of what Parliament does, the British Prime Minister still has the power to take Britain out of the EU under a no-deal scenario. But Theresa May is refusing to do that. And also, of course, the European Union the EU 27, the other 27 members of the EU, have to unanimously agree to an extension of Article 50. Otherwise, Britain automatically exits under a no-deal scenario. So actually, Parliament doesn't really control that process. The Prime Minister has the power to decide what happens, and also the European Union has to also come to a unanimous agreement if there's going to be an extension of Article 50 for, say, a few months or longer.
Oh, they have to be unanimous in order to give the extension? Well, that's a pretty high bar.
That is correct. Yeah, so one single European country, for example, France, could veto an extension. And certainly it's the hope of the Brexiteers in London that a country like France will veto an extension, forcing Britain out of the EU. That would be by far the best scenario. It remains to be seen exactly what happens on that front.
We only have a few minutes left. You just wrote an article in the Daily Telegraph, which is fascinating, and you talk about how America is ready, standing in the wings, to sort of scoop Britain up and help enhance its economic strength immediately, because people are talking about what a disaster a no-deal Brexit or a messy Brexit would be. You disagree, right?
Yeah, you know, I think the view certainly of the Trump administration, being very publicly, broadcast by the president and National Security Advisor John Bolton, is that the United States would be absolutely ready for Britain in a No Deal scenario, and the United States would welcome Britain with open arms in terms of moving forward with a U.S.-UK free trade agreement. And I think it's very much the view of the present U.S. administration that Britain outside of the EU is good for America. And it's, I think undoubtedly true that the U.S.-UK special relationship would be strengthened if Britain was outside of the EU. And I think this is very much the view of the Trump White House. And I think that the president has spoken on many occasions in support of Brexit, which he believes is as a great, great move forward for freedom in the world and great for the U.S.-UK special relationship.
Niall, if they should exit this morning, and it should be final, I hope that happens. This is all of the UK. This is Scotland and Ireland and England also. And Wales.
Well, if Britain does exit the EU on the evening of Friday, the April 12th, it would be the entire United Kingdom, Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And so, yes, that includes Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So this would be the entire United Kingdom leaving under a no deal if indeed that happened.
One last thing. I just read an article in Market Watch by George Soros in which he talks about how Europe is on the cusp of a nightmare, and he bases that on the dangers to the European Union, the dangers of us losing this grand vision because of all these factions in these country members, especially with the parties. Do you think the European Union is in danger of being imploding?
Yeah, I think the European Union has a very good chance of imploding. I think that there are deep-seated divisions within the EU. Britain basically is throwing a lifeboat off the Titanic, really. And eventually, the EU will find that its model is unsustainable. And the idea that you can submerge, 28 member states into one, political entity and economic entity, this is an idea that simply will not work. And so history has shown that there is no greater force than national sovereignty and the drive for freedom. And the EU does not represent national sovereignty or freedom.
Oh, Niall, don't you wish Margaret Thatcher were still there? There wouldn't even be.
Absolutely. Margaret Thatcher would have celebrated Brexit, and she would have certainly taken Britain outside of the EU.
Yeah. All right, well, let me refer you to this article that Niall has written. Why liberty-loving Americans back a no-deal Brexit. We'll put that on our Facebook page, and we will look anticipating what's going to happen this morning with Brexit. Niall Gardner, thank you so much with Heritage Foundation. We'll be right back. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Social media can be brilliant at connecting people across the world. But I'm deeply concerned that social media firms are still not doing enough to protect users from harmful content. And that's not good enough. So today, we're putting a legal duty of care on these companies to keep users safe. And if they fail to do so, tough punishments will be imposed. The era of social media firms regulating themselves is over. It's time to do things differently. It's time to keep our children safe.
That was Prime Minister Theresa May of Great Britain. And in keeping with our theme today of Britain potentially leaving the EU, Britain has been undergoing lots of upheaval. And one of those things is kind of a precursor to what many of us in the West expect to happen, at least further west in the United States, and that is a control, regulatory control of our usage of the Internet. The UK office, Home Office, just issued a statement in conjunction with what Theresa May just said, that a regulator that we're establishing will not be a paper tiger. It will be backed with tough enforcement powers that give it teeth. We're proposing heavy fines. Companies named and shamed, websites and apps who refuse to protect users blocked, and senior managers could face criminal charges. That's a chilling decision that's happening in Great Britain and will have great implications here. I've asked Ashkan Kazarian to join us again. She was with us recently, and she is a legal and research fellow at Tech Freedom. But Ashkan is more than that. She is an internet law and policy fellow and an expert at the Federalist Society's Emerging Technology Working Group. She is a graduate of Lomonosov Moscow State University, and she has her Master's of Law degree from Yale. She's working on her PhD in law at Lomonosov Moscow State University. But she's an expert on social media, and she did such a great job with us last time. I've asked her to join us today to talk about what's happened in Great Britain. Ashkan, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Sandy, for having me again.
All right, so how did this, why is Britain the leader on this? You know, Germany has kind of been the most draconian, right. So why Britain suddenly?
My guess would be that Theresa May, she is failing this Brexit process. She broke Europe, and now she has turned to break the Internet. She's just trying to pull attention away from all of her failures and play into all the fears that people have over social media.
Well, that's interesting. Well, okay, so let's talk about this policy. I did sort of give an overview, and so did she, but can you break it down for us? What exactly are the Brits going to do when it comes to social media companies?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So UK's proposal, first of all, it's going to cover any website that allows users to share or discover user-generated content or interact with each other online, a definition which potentially covers vast tranches of the Internet. And then this regulation that covers basically majority of the websites online and services online, it will impose a duty of care on the affected sites and hold them liable for restricting behaviors which are harmful but not necessarily illegal. So those sites which don't meet that duty of care can be fined, their senior managers can be held liable, or the regulator can even block the site entirely, demand that the ISP block that website in UK.
Yeah, so let's break it down even further. So that means that if you were a British citizen or you use the Internet over there, if you are a provider like, I don't know, if you're Facebook or Twitter, if you're Google and many other companies as well, you will be responsible for the content that is carried on your platform. And if you don't, yeah, as I understand it, Ashkan, if you don't take it down, like, is it 24 hours or 12 hours?
I read all the 100 pages of a proposal, and I did not see a number. I might have missed it. However, it has to be fast, good faith, according with the resources you have, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is this proposal, it will create this government agency to a completely new government agency to enforce these rules. It will be basically a ministry of censorship, plain and simple.
They're even going to create kind of like a, as I understand it, at least there's talk of creating like a police force. I mean, they're not maybe calling it that, but they will be policing content on the Internet. And you touched on this, but it's we need to repeat that. It's not just things that are harmful. Oh, well, wait, let me say it this way. It's not just things that are illegal.
Not just things that are illegal, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like child porn, death threats, you know, bloody gories, whatever, stuff that's just illegal to do. We're talking about arbitrary decisions on what's harmful, right?
Absolutely. And if you look into Europe, I yesterday was talking on CBS, and the British anchor kept pushing me that UK has free speech. Obviously, they have free speech compared to non-democratic countries, but it's way less than the First Amendment gives American citizens. And, for example, in EU, and these rules apply to UK, recently it was decided that an Austrian woman who said that Muhammad was a pedophile, that she can't say that she violated multiple laws and she was punished for that. Things like that, they're already illegal there. And then on top of that, they want to define harmful. And they don't really give any clarity in the 100 pages of a proposal. And they say that there's a lot of wiggle room for both the agency to decide what's harmful or not after the fact and for the companies to just figure it out.
Yes.
This is not only... Go ahead.
No, I'm joining in with you. This is the implications of what you're saying are very, very dangerous. And actually, Ashkin, I think you're referring to Elizabeth Sabadish Wolf. She was a guest with us a couple of months, 6 months ago, maybe. And she has been, I don't know if she went to jail, but she was fined. And she was a member of the government in that country. It's just amazing what the implications of this are. And I've seen kind of the breakdown of the kinds of social media, our internet content that they're going to be regulating. And let me just give the categories for you and also for people listening. Inciting violence and spreading violent content, including terrorist content. Most of us would say, well, that's probably a good idea. It's violent.
But if you think about it, a reporter who's going live on Facebook from Syria, that content would be marked too. That content wouldn't be able to see the light of day. A photo of a girl running away from a blast in Vietnam, that photo on the cover of National Geographic, if you share it, probably would be taken down too.
Interesting. Okay, so the here's the second category, encouraging self-harm or suicide. I think most of us would say, well, that's probably logical.
But you realize, again, this is so vague. Why don't you go through the categories and I can address them all together.
Yeah, I'm glad you're, let's do it. I mean, why is that vague? Let's address this one. Like self-harm, somebody might, go ahead.
So there are a lot of things that the internet does. And part of it is creating a community. And I've personally seen, I've heard stories of people who are depressed and are in a bad place and don't even know that they're a specialist or can't afford specialists to go help them. So this community online, obviously, is trying to help and support each other. Sometimes it fails. But all of these conversations are saving lives every day. People feel less alone. They feel like they're heard. So when you have a vague standard and you say to a company, we're going to fine you, we're going to put your executive in jail, they're going to take down any conversation that even discusses suicide. You know it's going to over-police. They're going to over-police the platforms themselves. And then on top of that, the government agency that UK is going to create is going to police even more.
This really is shocking coming from Britain, honestly, given its heritage. And, of course, it's our cousin. We learned a lot about what was free and what it meant to be free and what it meant not to be free from our heritage in Britain. But I think in many ways we pulled Britain, at least at one time, we were more at one. And they're moving further to the left from America. There's no question about it. This one makes me really nervous. I certainly understand the clear danger of this. And it is this one, the spread of disinformation and fake news. Now, who in the world is going to make, who is even able to make a decision on everything shared on social media about whether it's disinformation or fake news?
Oh, and if you look at United States precedent and all the cases that are heard in front of the Supreme Court or Circuit Court, the spread of fake news in the United States is allowed under the First Amendment, because we as a country understand that sometimes we have to assess ourselves what news we want to believe or what information we want to believe to make sure that there is no censorship. If UK adopts this proposal, the internet, as we know, will be over, because it's going to fragment. UK is such a big market, and it's a country that's, you know, a democratic, progressive country. And so tech companies will have to somehow deal with it.
Yes, and there's, now they're leaving it up to the tech companies to, they're supposed to enforce this and make all these judgments, or they're going to be heavily fined and worse, and even personally fined. As we said before, it's not just the company itself. I think probably, too, I just need to insert, and we talked about this last time we spoke, Kashkin. From my perspective, as long as you let people speak, that the truth will sort of make its way to the top. It's when you control, like the experience of the Soviet Union, when you only allow a one bit of news, one angle, one particular perspective, and don't allow any other dissent, that's when you're in trouble. And that's when propaganda can sway an entire people to some really lack of understanding of really what's true and what isn't. But when you allow a free flow of information, the truth can break its way through. Now, cyberbullying, what's the downside of that one?
Just before I address cyberbullying, I wanted to say that you're absolutely right comparing these rules to Soviet Union, because rules like this regulating social media companies, almost word for word, exist in China and Russia already. And now UK wants to take a page out of their book. They were just accusing Russia of meddling in their elections and meddling with their social media, and now they want to do the same thing. It's very confusing, and it's very dangerous. Now, I'm talking about cyberbullying. Cyberbullying is a huge problem, and it is important for us to focus on it and to talk about it. There are tools within the platform that help those who have been bullied to address it. There is law enforcement that has special units, I mean, depending on the country. But there are people in law enforcement who are trained to deal with cyberbullying when it gets dangerous for your life or your, you know, your safety. Now, we have to be very careful when we try to police content. But like, how do you even tag something as bullying? What if me and my friend on Twitter are joking and calling each other a funny name, and algorithms will just tag that as bullying? Yeah. There is no real way of knowing what's bullying or not until the person who's being bullied tells you.
Let me just add that there was an article or a report that was published on by Parliament's Digital Culture, Media, and Sport Committee. That may be what you read. Anyway, it was a report into fake news, branding social media companies digital gangsters, and said that it's important that the regulator, whoever it is that's going to be appointed, has the power to launch investigations when necessary. So this is not, this is super police, super police. It's not police. It's beyond the laws of that are on the books in Britain. This is the arbitrary opinion of these regulators, and so very dangerous. I'm curious to know, Ashkin, how you think this is going to affect the rest of the world in terms of the regulations for a freer society like the United States.
If the United Kingdom does this, other countries with way less checks and balances in their political regime would copy the model, and free speech would be even more restricted in countries that already have tyrants at the helm. On top of that, this obviously will affect the conversation we're having right now in the United States. Now, a proposal like this wouldn't fly in America because we have the First Amendment and we have this amazing amount of precedence that was created by our Supreme Court that would protect free speech and protect expression. But with voices from both the right, Ted Cruz, Senator Josh Hawley, and the left, Senator Elizabeth Warren, House Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they want to rein in the social media companies. And the way they see they want to assert their power is through content moderation, through government going into content moderation. And that's not very far off from what Theresa May is suggesting.
Yeah, it is certainly a dangerous situation, and certainly those of us that are conservative know where this is headed. We know that it's going to be aimed at many of us. I know that even in, I was just reading this morning, this is a little different, but Amazon is already taking off the extremist far right of conservatives like Tommy Robinson writing on nationalism in the UK. They're removing those kinds of books. But we know that it starts there, and then the net widens, and speech is narrowed and narrowed, and that's why the concern. Ashkan Kazarian, we appreciate your expertise, and thank you again for joining us this morning. It'll be interesting to see how these restrictions affect Britain in the coming elections, and the decision about its future with the European Union and all of the other things in between, because social media, as it is used here, to advance ideas and to create free thought, is going to be totally squelched in Great Britain, I believe. Ashkan, thank you for joining me. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It's an infectious video that's gone viral in a matter of days. The only difference between it and Pharrell Williams' original is that the people dancing are British Muslims. Hot air balloon that could go to space. Its creators say that they're promoting a message that UK Muslims are a diverse, cosmopolitan, and above all, happy lot. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. And why shouldn't they be? Islam is the fastest growing religion in the UK. New analysis of census figures even suggests that it could become the country's dominant religion in as little as 10 years' time. The number of Muslims in the UK has doubled in the past decade, with Muhammad now the most popular name for baby boys in London.
The average age for the British Muslim community is around 26. So the British Muslim population is incredibly young. And you have this energy, this vibrancy, this sizzling, crackling energy. Like happiness
is the truth. In many ways, the UK is a trailblazer. It's set to become the first non-Muslim country to launch a financial bond that can be bought by Islamic investors, while the Law Society recently issued guidelines for drafting Sharia wills, citing rising demand. Unlike the viral popularity of Islam, the new analysis of latest census figures by the Office for National Statistics shows that the Church of England is declining 50% faster than was previously thought. The country's aging Christian demographic means that its official religion has experienced a loss of more than 4 million worshippers since 2001.
The decline of churches in the UK's long term, it just happens to be now approaching really rock bottom. So 95% of people don't attend a church on an average Sunday.
That was a report from RT Britain, and pretty gripping. And given our coverage of what's happening in Great Britain today, I thought it was appropriate to talk about what the potential exit of Great Britain, or the Brexit, from the European Union, what effect it will have on Christians in Great Britain. And after all, by the way, what is life like for a British Christian right now? I've asked Stephen Green to join us. He's the National Director of Christian Voice. He's constantly doing some great reporting about what's happening in Great Britain on a daily basis to people that really do actually believe, who are faithful Christians, and he's one of them. And so I've asked him to join us this morning to just chat about what's going on in Great Britain. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Sandy. Of course, it's afternoon here in the UK, but good morning to you.
Yes, of course it is. You know, I'm curious to know when, you know, the Church of England has been the predominant church in Great Britain since the time of, well, there was a battle over the Church of England and Catholics, but it started at least with Henry the Eighth. But it was sort of sorted out, and the Church of England became the official state church. But now we heard that report, and I'm sure I don't need to tell you, you're living it. Do you think it is the rise of Islam in Great Britain that is causing the most angst and the loss of a vital church in Great Britain?
Look, certainly we can trace our Christian heritage here back to the first century. Make no mistake about that. There was a vibrant Celtic church here between the first and the sixth centuries, before Augustine pitched up here from Rome. So yeah, our Christian heritage goes back a long, long way. And we do have a growing Muslim population, and your report was partly right in that. Perhaps in 20 or 30 years' time, there'll be a tipping point where you will have maybe a majority of MPs will be of the Muslim faith. Now, interestingly, right at this moment, in terms of the Islamic case, the big talking point is that Muslims are taking their children out of secularist relationships and sex education here in England, in Birmingham, over the issue of LGBT propaganda. Relationships education is being used as a vehicle for books like Mama, Mommy and Me, King and King, all this sort of primary school age we're talking about, so, 4, 5, 6-year-olds having this propaganda. So it's a strange situation in which Christians and Jews and Muslims find themselves on the same side on this particular one. As for the longer term, we're going to have to leave that to the Almighty, but it is true that that Christian people, Christian women, are not having the number of children that Muslim women have. And I'm not blaming the Muslim women for that. They are simply doing what their bodies are designed to do. But we've got a bit of a contraceptive culture, and we're not keeping up, and we need to. And as for the demographics, it's just simply up to the church to get out there on the streets and tell people about Jesus, and not wait until they come into the church. We should be out there, and it's a challenge for us.
Yes, back in the 70s, I remember becoming aware that the Baptist Church and the Free Churches in Britain were actually pretty strong. And then take it further, fast forward probably about 15 years ago, I interviewed Winston Churchill's niece. And interestingly enough, I asked her during a commercial break where Winston Churchill got his, in spite of his language and some of the other things about him, so much of what he said was so Christian. And, remember he and Franklin Roosevelt had a worship service on a battleship singing hymns together. And I asked her where that came from. And she said that Winston Churchill had a nanny who was part of the Free Church who raised him and taught him scriptures. Which I thought was very interesting. My point is only, Stephen, that there was a passionate, strong evangelical strain in Britain, apart from the Church of England, for a long time. Is it still there?
Well, yes, I mean, it is. And again, I go back to our heritage, because it was in the 9th century that the Archbishop Dunstan anointed King Edgar in Bath Abbey. In a service which has been replicated ever since. So even our present Queen, on the 2nd of June 1953, swore to uphold the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel. Now, whether she does or not is down to that band of unscrupulous, ambitious, wicked men whom we call the Queen's ministers. But nevertheless, we have a Christian constitution in our land, and which is honoured more in the breach than the observance, I must say. But we need national repentance in this land. There's no doubt about that. And it's quite possible that coming out of the European Union might provide a spur for that. I don't know. That's all in the hands of the Almighty.
Yes, and so I want to ask you about that. As you look to the potential of Britain shaking loose from the EU, Stephen, we don't have to spend a lot of time talking about how pagan the EU is. There was a meeting of the leaders of the EU. I wasn't planning on saying this. It seemed to me there was an opening of a bridge or a tunnel in one of the countries of Europe. I can't recall if it's Luxembourg, someplace like that. And they had the most pagan, unbelievably raw pagan entertainment, like horns and hooks and people without clothing, and just like a remind me of a gay pride parade. And these European leaders were sitting there, you know, enjoying all of this. And of course, the real actions of the EU confirm that they are, they're certainly a godless entity. They have been enemies, really, to Christians. Okay, that being said, what do you think would happen to Christians in Britain if you left the EU?
Yeah, well, you're talking about the Gotthard-based tunnel, which is a railway tunnel through the Alps in Switzerland.
Yeah,
and,
okay.
Yeah, it's very true that the opening ceremony of that was had a lot of paganism. I think it was farmed out to some designers just out of art school to put it all together, and they brought a whole lot of the spirits of the mountain and all that kind of rubbish into it. So that had, I mean, when we had the London Olympics here in 2012, you know, you got the same kind of thing. It needs a lot of prayer, but that's not really to do with the European Union. 3 years ago, and it seems crazy it was 3 years ago, I went around three European capitals, well, two that really are, and one that thinks it is. The one that thinks it is Strasbourg, which is one of the sites of the European Parliament. You know, the European Parliament is based in two cities, in Brussels and in Strasbourg, and it moves between the two. It has the one in Strasbourg because the French won't give up their claim to host the Parliament. So that's crazy. But anyway, so I went to Brussels and to Strasbourg and to Rome. And in Strasbourg, I saw the tower of the European Parliament, which is deliberately constructed to look like Pieter Bruegel's painting of the unfinished Tower of Babel. So there he is. We have this tower there in Strasbourg, which looks deliberately unfinished. Bits of it on one side aren't there. But nobody's coming along to put some more bricks on. That is how it is. It's a deliberate throwback to the Tower of Babel. It's almost as if the European Union is trying to recreate that. And then I went to Brussels and I saw a woman riding a beast. Now, there's a depiction of her in Strasbourg as well. She was on a UK stamp riding the beast. She's been on Greek and Italian 2 euro coins. On the 2 euro coins, this is scary, the woman is actually writing the EU constitution. So, and of course, this goes back to a myth of Greek mythology, where the Greek god Zeus changed himself into a bull, as you do, and he enticed Europa, who was a Phoenician princess, onto his back. And then he made off with her and landed up in Crete, where he threw the bull symbol into the heavens, where it became the Taurus constellation. I hope you're still with me. And then he raped Europa. So when we see this symbol of the European Union, of the woman on the beast, and she is called Europa. Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter, because the Romans adopted all the Greek gods and renamed Zeus Jupiter. So when we see the people of Europe being depicted as a woman who's being carted off to Crete to be raped, you know, we're like, hang on a minute, guys, where are you taking us and for what purpose? So that's scary. Then I went to Rome, and everybody knows that the 1957, I think it was, Treaty of Rome was signed in Rome. But where was it signed in Rome? It was signed in a building built on top of Jupiter's temple in Rome. And from Revelation chapter 2, we know that the temple of Zeus in Pergamos was Satan's seat. And so the European Union's founding treaty, the Treaty of Rome, was signed on top of Satan's seat in Rome. And it was a deliberate act. The guy who put the whole European Union project together was a guy called Paul-Henri Spaak, Belgian, and he determined where it was going to be signed. And Juno said, he said on the eve of the signing of the Treaty of Rome, he said to his friend Baron Robert Rothschild, he said, do you know, Robert, he said, I think we have recreated the Roman Empire without firing a shot. So
wow.
He knew that he was recreating the Roman Empire. And
that's,
you know,
fascinating.
And this is the spirit which went through Babylon into Persia into Greece into Rome and is now deliberately recreated in the European Union. And in Revelation chapter 17, we read that these will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will triumph over them. And I know which side I want this United Kingdom to be on when that particular one breaks out.
Wow, that's I would think that you were exaggerating, except I know that you're not. I've seen enough with my own eyes. And we've seen enough wickedness.
If you search on YouTube for European Union Women on the Beast, European Union, Tara Bagel,
European Union's
Pagan Foundation. Yeah. All my videos are up there. So
yes.
It's there.
Okay. You know, we should give your, it's christianvoice.com, Christian Voice. Can they find you?
Yeah, christianvoice.org.uk or just go ukcv.org and you'll get there.
Yeah, and I guess they should do that pretty quickly before those social media constraints kick in that the United Kingdom has just instituted. But Stephen, we only have a couple of minutes left. So practically speaking, you think that Brexit is a good thing for Christians in Great Britain?
I think it's a good thing for the United Kingdom. And don't forget, in Jeremiah, we are told to pray for the peace of the country where we've been carried captive or where we happen to find ourselves. Because in the peace thereof, you will have peace. And I can't see any downside to Brexit if it enables us to reestablish our commitment as a constitutional monarchy under God. Then that's got to be a good thing. Because make no mistake, when they were writing the constitution for the EU, which actually never came to anything, but there was no mention of God in it. It's a deliberately pagan
construct. Stephen, we're out of time, but listen, fascinating stuff. You and I will have to talk again. Stephen Green, the National Director of Christian Voice. You can get that online. You can get his information online, and I do recommend it. God bless you, Stephen, and of course, we'll wait to see what happens with Brexit today. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.